This April, the small nonprofit is being sponsored by Troy Mailing. That's T-R-O-I Mailing. Friends, I've personally been using Troy's printing and mailing services for almost 5 years now. I choose them for my clients, and I chose them when I was in-house. They are great to work with, always get my brand colors right, are cost-effective, and get my mailouts to my donors on time, even during busy seasons. Call 1-866-876-4624 for a free $100 postage credit when you use promo code DONORDM1 on your next campaign. Thank you, Troy Mailing, for sponsoring the small nonprofit.
Welcome to the Small Nonprofit Podcast with down-to-earth practical advice on how to get things done in your small organization. You are going to change the world and we can help. Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, Cindy Wagman, and I'm joined by my co-host, Anya McGlynn.
Hello, everyone.
So today we are talking about social innovation, which I think is this really fascinating, great topic. It's a little bit of a buzzword, but there's also a lot organizations can learn and do around social innovation without, you know, diving into the deep end. And
I think some of the misconceptions that we have around social innovation is that it's a thing that you do and you decide on a program and you're like, we're going to do social innovation. But in fact, it's a process, right?
Exactly.
And so it actually, if you're going to be an organization that's interested in social innovation, it ends up infusing everything that you do. And there's not one outcome that you say, this is social innovation. It's not quite as concrete as that. So I think, you know, for those of you who are working on socially innovative programs that you know are making a difference in a way that's maybe untraditional, that hasn't been tried or tested before, I think that you're probably well positioned to understand that it is a process and not an outcome.
What I love about this interview with Geraldine is that she talks about instances of social innovation and examples of how you can think about social innovation in a way that impacts your organization's day-to-day work, but also the way you think about changing the world.
That's right. And you know, charities have always really been doing social innovation work, right? I mean, for most of us, our MO is to approach a problem in a new way and in a way that solves the problem, right? And at the heart of social innovation is this notion that we have a society that operates in a specific way that tends to leave a lot of people out and leaves a lot of people marginalized. And so what are the ways in which we can innovate that society in a way that becomes more inclusive, right? And becomes more sustainable.
Exactly. So if you are not really sure if you are socially innovative or want to take the steps to become more of a social innovation based organization, this is a great interview. Really breaks it down and helps you think about it as a process, not just an outcome.
Absolutely.
Geraldine Cahill is co-author of Social Innovation Generation, Fostering a Canadian Ecosystem for Systems Change, published in November 2017 by the McConnell Foundation. She joined Social Innovation Generation, or SIG, in 2009 as a communications coordinator, leading communication efforts across the partnership and later managing programs and partnerships for the SIG National Office. Geraldine is now working to launch Up Social Canada, a social solutions and scaling platform first developed in Barcelona. She's also chair of the Jane's Walk Steering Committee and animates the partnership brokers GTHA community of practice. Enjoy the interview. Geraldine, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Cindy.
I'm so excited for this conversation because I feel like social innovation is a growing sort of movement, if you will, but a lot of people still don't understand exactly what it is, if it's even easy to define. And so I thought we could start with a little bit of looking at what is this mysterious thing called social innovation.
Sure, we can go there into that murky zone. That's totally understandable. I think when we talk about social innovation, you will probably, many people listening would recognize that there are differing opinions about what qualifies, in inverted commas, social innovation. I am a student of Dr. Frances Wesley, and her work in social innovation has developed over the last several decades. And so I subscribe to probably a tighter definition than some. Mm-hmm. You know, the broad understanding of social innovation is it's focused on new ideas that work to transform and better the systems in which we operate in society, and also remembering our natural environments as well. Frances Wesley's work is really focused on new policies, platforms, processes that are intentionally focused on that complete transformation rather than a slow incremental changes to make something better to be in, like more resilient. Mm-hmm. There's nothing wrong with a concentration on building resiliency, but in a social innovation world, we would be looking at how we can also prototype, experiment, and grow alternate systems that are ultimately better for everybody. So it really focused on transformation and scaling that transformation so that it becomes a new way of being in the world.
Wow. Those are some lofty goals.
For sure. But we've got to be ambitious.
Exactly. And we know there are so many problems with our existing systems that that creating or looking at alternatives is probably in some ways easier than dismantling some of what we're used to or operate within. So it makes a lot of sense. But I can also see it being really challenging for small organizations where it feels like you don't even have time to brush your teeth. How are you going to create a new system while you're still focused on dismantling our existing one? What advice do you have to someone who's in a small organization and wants to, let's say, dabble in social innovation? Is there such thing? Can you do that?
Well, yeah, dabbling is, yeah, it's funny when you follow my ambitious, you know, headline opening with dabbling in these things. And I think what I can say is that, you know, fundamentally as nonprofits and charities working to better the world in broad strokes, mm-hmm. We all can afford to take some time to reflect mm-hmm. on what is the impact we are trying to achieve, and are we setting ourselves up to really work towards that impact. And I know that many people will be familiar with the kind of, you know, interweave theories of change type work that's been mm. popular over the last several years, working our way back from the ultimate impact we want to achieve and thinking through the activities, the strategic activities and audiences and so on that that can work towards that change. But if we don't set aside the time to stop and reflect, that reflective time is a part of our active learning, and everybody can afford to do that. It doesn't need to be, you know, putting everything on hold for 6 months, but it does need to be a dedicated time that is regarded as essential as all the other services that you're trying to provide, because without that reflection, you may well be just sort of steamrolling through a whole bunch of activities that aren't going to get you to that ultimate impact that you seek. That's sort of step one, how I think about things in small organizations is mm-hmm. that we are all running around crazy, like with our heads cut off a little bit, a lot of the time, you know, but
I think your reflection on that is actually bang on, which is some of that running around with our heads cut off is inertia, right? It is exactly what you want us to break from, which is stop doing things just because we've been doing them. Mm-hmm. Carve out a little bit of time to think more reflectively about the impact and really look at, I mean, it's a really hard conversation to have with ourselves, which is, are we doing what we say we're doing? And are we having the impact that we say we're having? And if not, what do we change?
Yeah. And how do we change that? And there's a lot of, resources available for looking at how to do that reflective practice. Well, here in Canada, there's a CKX is sort of dedicated to this space. For those that are aware of CKX, it's CKX.org. Anyone can find it. Sort of built, grew out of a focus from Community Foundations Canada. Is now its own sort of organization, and is a good one to look at for inspiration and ideas. But another methodology I've found really useful, and once again, I preface this with apologizing in advance for a sort of academic look at things, but it's not about it being academic. It's just a visual and thinking resource that I find helpful, which is looking at the adaptive cycle. And there are lots of places you can find this online, certainly on Social Innovation Generation's website, which is still live, sigeneration.ca. You can find the adaptive cycle. But what it does is it, as a visual aid and as a thinking aid, it really helps you to stop and look at where are you on your organization's journey at this point in time. Are you in the process of launching something new? Are you at a stage where your organization is quite mature, even if it's small? Has it learned a few things, and is it stuck a little bit in a way of doing things that may have lost some of the rigor and intensity that the organization as a whole needs to keep growing? Are there things that you can let go of to redeploy into other areas? I find that visual aid really useful as well. So that's another way of looking at the organization, sort of taking a step back and thinking, okay, where am I in this process? And also, where is the organization in this cycle of growth and renewal? And something that I encourage myself and other people to do for sure.
Excellent. And without having the visual, we'll link to that visual, but without having it in front of people as they're listening, can you talk a little bit about what it looks like and maybe what kinds of questions you can ask yourself at any to identify which level or stage you are, your organization is in?
Yeah, for sure. I can do that. The main thing is that usually before you launch an idea, you have a period of time, what they refer to in the sort of social innovation theory side of things as, that period of time before you get something started where you're tossing around all sorts of ideas. It may be that, you know, you have new people have joined the organization potentially where they've brought in a bunch of new ideas, or you've been in a process of learning new ideas and you're thinking, how can I best deploy the energies that I have? Who are the partners I might need to engage? Where are the resources going to come from, like financial, staffing? Which ideas have, for lots of different reasons, the most chance of succeeding? You go through a process of addressing that yourself. That's sort of called the sort of reorganization phase. And then when you make some decisions because you have support for the idea, you have sort of a plan for the idea, you have done a sense making period of reflection about, you know, this is the best way I can think of right now to get to that ultimate impact or part of the ultimate impact. And so you set off just like an entrepreneur might do in the sort of for-profit space. You launch the idea and you've got the momentum behind you to pursue something. And during that phase, you really want to look for a careful assessment of, is this sort of constant checking in, that sort of evaluation as you go, developmental evaluation, if you like, to say, is this growing in all the right ways? Am I the best person to be leading this right now? Is it actually hitting some of the notes that I thought it was? Or is it, before I get too far and spend all my resources, should I think about going back to that original set of ideas and reviewing where I'm at? Or do I want to keep growing it? Do I have the momentum there? And then once you get to that sort of mature state of where you were really hoping to have the success and track record of success for the idea, you're like, this is amazing and this is ticking all the boxes that I thought it was. Is this worth holding on to this energy right now, that all the energy that I need to keep this going, or are there better ways now that I could potentially grow out that idea, maybe let go of some of the control and let others take over? Or can some of that energy be set aside for renewal, for new ideas, and sort of let go of some of the energy you've put towards that really great thing that maybe now 2, 3, 4 years into development, maybe longer. I'm just thinking of smaller organizations where you may not be able to maintain something for, a couple of decades type thing. But what can I let go of so I can renew myself and also renew the organization with new ideas and get something else into the water supply? So, I mean, I'm thinking it through like that. That's a pretty, I think, just a way of thinking through where you are. And usually what I've learned from others, more than just from learning this way of thinking about myself and about organizations where I'm working, is you could track that cycle of thinking through just about any project that you're doing. So it may not apply to the whole organization, or it may just apply to a particular program. It's effective no matter whether you apply it at that very sort of small one project scale or whether you apply it to the whole organization.
That's fantastic. And it's a cycle. So it continues. This is almost like a way of being instead of an end product, right? This is something that you can build into your organization's culture.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
And really valuable thinking and reflection time. I know I keep saying that, but it's really worth doing for sure. Yeah.
I love the part of it where it's the learning to let go of some things, like really questioning, should you be doing all these things? What's working? And if it's not working, or if it's not feeding that next phase, what can you let go of? Because I feel like that is something we can get better at doing, which is learning to drop things altogether or delegate or look at it in a different way. Mm-hmm. And I think our sector, especially leaders in our sector, really owe that to themselves to think about.
Yeah, for sure. The other thing to do, which I find we're increasingly better able to do, perhaps more awake to, is partnering with other organizations so that you're not expending all of your own resources, but you're actually expanding the impact that you can have by partnering thoughtfully with organizations like or even unlike yourself that may be trying to get to that same point. That ultimate impact together, so that you're not, all exhausted trying to do it all by yourself. So it's just another thing to stay awake to. And I would, that's one thing to check in with before you launch the new idea. And also as you're growing it out and you're thinking, wow, I am totally excited by this still, but I am running out of steam and perhaps I need to bring on some others to see if we can keep this going. And of course, then at the mature stage where you're thinking, oh, I could offload some of this now so I can do something else, it's all sorts of ways to look at it.
I think that's so great. And we do see more and more organizations collaborate both on the like service side, but also I think there's going to be a growing trend around sharing some back-end resources. So sharing space and bookkeepers and other staff that you don't always need full time in-house, but that you can actually create an ecosystem to support a bunch of organizations that are doing good work. So there's the service delivery as well as the systems, which I think is a huge shift coming our way.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's funny because the co-location spaces, the community spaces, the Center for Social Innovation and the myriad others that have started in its wake, we've sort of become so used to them. It feels like, oh, yeah, of course we would do that. But that was not a for sure thing. And when CSI launched all those years ago, it was like never a sure bet. It was new as an idea. It was like, what are you doing? But now we really, now these are shared spaces and shared ways of organizing to reduce the burden on having us all set up separately. So it's like this transformative idea that is now, you know, a few decades old, and we're like, oh yeah, of course, that's how we do things. But that's innovation in action itself.
Yeah, it makes so much sense now, but it took someone a very long time to think about it.
Yeah, exactly.
So I'd love to have you share a couple examples of this process and how it's worked for organizations that are, like our listeners, small, and walk us through. I mean, maybe not the whole cycle, but the process of saying, okay, this is important for us, carving out the space to do it, and then what was actually done.
Sure. Okay, so I'll try and think of some that have, perhaps a couple where it's really obvious what has happened and has been or continues to be successful, and then perhaps learning from one also where perhaps it wasn't, it didn't go exactly as planned.
Fabulous.
So if I think about one of the more inspiring projects I've come across in the last several years has been the Winnipeg Boldness Project, out of Winnipeg, obviously, out of the North End there. And, there in the North End was, significant challenges in the social welfare systems, a lot of, pressure on the sort of the child welfare and sort of family intervention services. These systems that had not been better equipped to prepare our youngest people for school readiness, for sort of getting ready to sort of be and grow in the world. The Winnipeg Boldness Project was really committed to trying to address the systemic challenges that prevent that readiness in the earliest years of life. It's an Indigenous-run organization and really embraced for the first time in its lifetime, but also one of the earlier projects that I was familiar with that set itself up to work with lab-like methodologies, so social lab processes, design thinking processes that took what was a sort of a classic series of welfare-based challenges and sort of systemic issues, and rather than setting up a nonprofit that was structured around a sort of strategic plan that was that knew step by step where it was aiming to go and would check in year by year in that sort of traditional operational way, instead said, we're going to take a a whole systems approach to this, and we're going to develop some design practices to better understand where our individual challenges are in these various areas engaged in this problem. And we're going to experiment through a series of different engagements with community and try and see what challenge some of our assumptions about what we think are the problems, and then do some prototyping to develop out new programs and services that better address the challenge that we're trying to solve. So they're several years into their six-year plan to date, and have had and continue to have considerable success with this approach. They're very much a learning by doing organization. When you go to visit them in Winnipeg, you know, they look like perhaps some of those organizations that we think, oh God, you sit around with post-it notes all the time and you just pick a whole bunch of things up on the wall and you think that that's going to create change. And in fact, that's exactly what it looks like when you go there. They have this great space for gatherings and for design led approaches, and it's full of post-it notes and drawings and all of that stuff, all of it, but they are having you know, the impact that they're really seeking, so you can't sort of argue with that, I guess. That's one that people could look at if they were interested. I can't remember exactly the size of the team or if it's grown since I've been there, which is a couple of years now. So, but I think there was about 10 people working out of that office on and off. Another organization that is an inspiration to me is Execo, based out of Montreal. And they're really looking at addressing the problem of various communities of people in city systems and also in regional areas that face degrees of social exclusion. And this often plays out for people that are living in situations of homelessness, that lack the sort of social and economic opportunities that are available to other people. You might be looking at people experiencing mental health challenges, or even ethnic and racial prejudices as well. All these communities experiencing various forms of social exclusion that also result in the systemic problem of assuming intelligence based on how much you're able to participate in the world. So it's a really interesting group that has been operating for several years now, and the ways that they engage these communities that are so often excluded to showcase the strengths and assets and intelligence that they bring to our city systems that we wouldn't see otherwise. So one of my favorite stories from them was about how they played with the idea of challenging a community of Inuit that were living in situations of homelessness in Montreal, and they engaged the Museum of Fine Art in the city. And they asked the museum if they could bring out into the streets the artifacts from the Inuit community that had been collected by the museum over the years. And they had the local Inuit people speak on the street to passers-by about why these artifacts were significant for their community, and were transferring their local knowledge, their cultural knowledge to the community. And it absolutely flew in the face of traditional, in quotes, intelligence and knowledge systems for sort of our you know, our versions of what museums' roles are. Even, you know, you could play it out into libraries or education systems where participation from these communities of excluded people would never be heard. Like, it's just a quick example of playing with what we expect or what we have assumed about people's contribution to the world, and really putting a spotlight on those contributions that can be made if the space is made available to them. So that's just a small example, but one of them that I really love. And I know that Execo continues to push themselves as an organization to go into more ambitious and experimental spaces. They try and set aside a portion of their work for experimenting on various ways of doing things. They use a lot of artistic and sort of circus-based practices as well. They're sort of an art-informed practice. So that's quite a bit different from even the first example I used, and certainly different from many of the other organizations that, you know, maybe listening, but that I've worked in, for example, as well. So I really love their practice as well.
Great organization. Now, before we talk about an example that maybe didn't work as well as anticipated, I want to talk or hear from you a little bit about this idea of experimentation and prototyping, because that definitely comes across in those two examples of organizations that are willing to not only do the work and create the space to reflect, but to understand that you're not going to get it perfect the first time, and that it's actually a lot of, I mean, you said playful as well with that second organization. I think that's really true, is a lot of experimentation is pushing outside of our comfort zones and thinking about things in new structures and frameworks and trying, right? Like letting go of our ego and just trying something new.
Yeah.
Tell us about that process.
For sure. Well, there's a lot of resources that are sort of in these big and growing buckets of activity now around design thinking or rapid prototyping, experimentation. Once again, I'll just point out that the CKX, or the Community Knowledge Exchange that I brought up earlier, they and myself worked on a report earlier this year after they supported a range of small and medium-sized nonprofits and charities to do some of this experimentation work. They published a report called Ready, Set, Experiment that is available on their website. So there are resources out there which you can use to start to think about doing this work. So one of the other organizations that I think is doing really great work is In With Forward, which use certainly design-informed practices to do the kind of experimentation, rapid prototyping of new ways of delivering services, service design work, which they have been, or certainly the woman that leads In With Forward, Sarah Shulman, has been developing this this thinking and doing approach for several years now. She started in Australia, went to Europe, is now in Canada and growing out the organization here in Vancouver and also here in Toronto. So people can also visit the In With Forward site for greater detail as well. But the kinds of things, it's not about saying I have to be like a design sort of scientist now and I have to have a whole new set of skills. It really is about learning by doing. And we spoke earlier, you raised the thought that we could dabble a little bit in these social innovation processes, and I was sort of laughing about it, but in some ways it's true. You can start anywhere. You can you can invest a small amount of time to play with this so that you're not, so it doesn't seem so vastly big and different from how you're doing things. And some of the stories that I've heard are, you know, also may not look like rocket science. And I think that they're good for that reason too. Mm-hmm. You know, I know a lot of charities and nonprofits over the last several years have probably been challenged a little bit by changes to a lot of foundations' granting streams and so on. And so it can be really difficult, I know, even for myself, to always be adjusting the ways that you say you're going about doing things. But I think that there are ways that we can begin to come closer together by just experimenting a little bit. A couple of the organizations that I've come across that have tried to do some small scale experimentation just to dip their toe in, if you like. Mm-hmm. One that comes to mind is the Montreal Urban Aboriginal Community Strategy Network. They have a large membership community around them, but they're a small team, very small. And they, rather than do a classic sort of report back to their funder, they actually went through a longer period of collecting stories from their community members to basically develop out a story-based report rather than a classic, this mm-hmm. is what we did, this is what we learned, to better reflect the needs and wants and stories of the people that were directly benefited by their organization.
Wow.
It doesn't seem like so ambitious, but in fact was really informative for them moving forward, and also a great way to report back to a funder about how their impact is being felt.
Fantastic.
Also, another example that comes to mind is, you know, the Alberta Recreation and Parks Association. These kinds of organizations exist all over the country. Mm-hmm. Now, they decided what they weren't doing well, and I think this can apply to all sorts of organizations as well, is the impacts and their relationship with Indigenous communities as well. So they worked with elders to discuss Indigenous concepts surrounding parks with a focus on the cultural and spiritual significance of the land, so that they could get a better sense of how they were in the spaces and places in the work that they were doing around the province, like what impacts that was having to the relationships with Indigenous people, but also how were they not incorporating the Indigenous worldviews and Indigenous ways of knowing and experiencing these places in the work that they had traditionally been doing. Mm-hmm. So that's another example that that comes to mind. And another organization that I'd love to highlight too is West Neighborhood House. West Neighborhood House here in Toronto is a larger, traditionally sort of social service focused organization. They have worked a lot with In With Forward, who I brought up earlier, and really have transformed many of their more classic service focused practices to engage in some of these what they call persona-based experiments. So we thought that we were focused on XYZ beneficiary of our services, but actually were we really understanding who those people were? What was their lived experience of a day when they left our building? How could we be better serving and also being in relationship with the people that take up our services as well? So they're really an outstanding organization. In terms of the one that I thought we could learn from, it's actually kind of an interesting story. So TYZE, was actually a technology-based platform that was developed by Vicky Kamak, who was one of two people who successfully launched and scaled the Registered Disability Savings Plan here in Canada, also a social innovation. She turned her attention in more recent years to addressing the problem of not adequately resourcing and also recognizing our natural care systems. So people, sons and daughters and other neighbors and so on that provide care informally in our communities to, you know, this is sort of times 1 million, millions of people that are delivering what she would call this sort of natural care, which keeps our sort of society rolling over. How can we better support the natural delivery of care, but also support it in a way that really enhances the overall experience of somebody who is suffering perhaps from either health challenges or other sorts of struggles. So she developed a platform which was really interacting with our formal healthcare system and our natural healthcare systems, and setting up a platform where you put the person who may be experiencing either a short-term or a long-term illness, perhaps, or is just living alone and is elderly. You put them in the center of your circle, and then you create a system of relationships between perhaps people who regularly stop in, provide various types of support, physiotherapy, dentists, doctors, and so on. You put them all in your circle around your person, and you have the systems talking to one another so that we could get a better sense, perhaps if we're not living close to the person that's at the center. But you'll recognize there's someone that is important to that person on the platform that you're able to check in to make sure that they're getting groceries delivered or getting out to a hospital appointment or whatever. So this was a really, you know, transformative idea. She got an incredible amount of support early on to develop the technology, to do the sort of scientifically backed, you know, control trials and all of the stuff that proved its efficacy and how it could be developed. But in fact, to some degree, she would reflect today, she grew it out to a point where it was actually bought kind of in that classic sort of entrepreneur mold. It was sold to a healthcare agency, the St. Elizabeth agency, to what they all hoped would scale it out even further, because here you have a very big system player who could scale that out across the country. But in fact, she would reflect on it now, Vicky, and saying it was almost like an idea a little too early for the scale of technology required to make it successful. So I know they're in a process of reflection, the St. Elizabeth folks. So it's one to keep an eye out for. But she had started this some years ago, and she was, she would say, too early for the idea to really take flight in the way that it needed to without burning through, like, literally millions of dollars. So, you know, sometimes you just, you know, you live and you learn through the pain of trying. And it may be that it needs a refresh, maybe some renewal. Maybe St. Elizabeth has a different way of looking at it now. I'm not sure. That's one to keep an eye out for, because I think they, you know, that's sort of very much in flux right now. But that was one to learn from as well.
Fantastic. So I think there's a lot that people can take away from this conversation. One is that, you know, although we're talking about massive systems changing and, you know, rethinking or relooking at old problems in new ways, or even defining problems completely differently, it can be massive, but it can also, we can dabble. We don't want to say that. And I think the adaptive cycle that you reference is a really good starting point for people, because I think where we often get stuck is that we look at these examples and we look at all these different, you know, organizations that are doing a good job or who had a great idea but it didn't work. But it's really hard sometimes to take those first few steps. And I feel like that, combined with the experimentation and learning by doing, is a really important message or lesson for small organizations, where you can start doing these things and it doesn't have to blow up your existing organization, and you can have improved outcomes, which we all want. So I think that's really helpful for our listeners. Thank you.
Well, that's my pleasure. Obviously, I hope that it's helpful, and I'd be happy to follow up with anybody too that had further questions coming out of this.
Fantastic. Geraldine, thank you again. And my message to all our listeners, go out and try something. Try something new. Think about something different way. Carve out the time and space to really look at how you can dabble in social innovation.
That sounds good. Thanks so much, Cindy.
Thank you.
Well, folks, that's it for today's episode of The Small Nonprofit. I'm your host, Cindy Wagman, and this show is brought to you by The Good Partnership. As a reminder, if you want more resources around raising more money for your small nonprofit, visit thegoodpartnership.com and download our free fundraising strategy guide. I'll see you next week.